The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted schools across the country, and teachers are stepping up.
We're learning from each other. We're becoming each other's students.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from a teacher's union leader and an educator about how programs are adapting. We'll also hear how the pandemic is affecting Alzheimer's patients and spend an academic minute fishing for a cure for Parkinson's. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. The lives of students and teachers have been turned upside down by the coronavirus. Almost overnight, in-class educators from kindergarten all the way to graduate school have had to convert their programs to distance learning. Communication and cooperation have never been more important. Here to talk about this new normal around the country is Lily Eskelson-Garcia, the president of the National Education Association. The NEA is the largest labor union in the country, representing 3 million educators. She says, like the schools, the union is operating the best it can under the circumstances.
So, you know, if you go to the National Education Association building, three blocks up from the White House, the lights are off. Everybody's social distancing. Everybody, like myself, is on the phone, on a computer, doing a video call or an email or a text. We're doing a lot of phone calls. We're talking to each other. We're trying to find our way through this dark time. The lights are on in our kitchen. We're making this work.
What are you hearing from your members, and is it different from large school districts to small ones?
Here is what is universal, large or small school district. We're really hearing about two particular issues. First of all, everyone was stunned. I think the world, not just teachers, the world was stunned. What? Stay home? What? Not get up and get in your car and go to work? And so, first of all, and I'm an elementary teacher, I have taught 39 sixth graders in the same room. And some reporter thought, you know, like, okay, how do you replicate what you did yesterday digitally tomorrow? You don't. You do not. You can't replicate hugging a child and, you know, telling kids that's not how we act, that when we're angry, here's what we do. The social emotional lessons that go along with reading, writing, and arithmetic. Kids in the same room learning from each other, questioning, debating, arguing. No, you don't do it in the same way. And so every teacher that I know, except for the very few who are experts in distance learning, and there are degrees for that, most of us, 99% of us, show up in a classroom and we talk to our students from preschool to graduate school. And so they were panicked. My superintendent says, you're still on the payroll. You're still on the job. I need you to do what you're doing with these 30-something kids digitally tomorrow. So one of the things that our union, the National Education Association, can do is connect people digitally who are saying, I've got a special needs kid. I've got a gifted and talented calculus class. And they're connecting with people who have tried something. We're learning from each other. We're becoming each other's students. And it's helping us stay awake, alive, professional, giving meaning to this important work that we do to give a meaningful experience to our students. But number two, what I'm hearing from universally is I've got some kids that have it all at home. They've got Wi-Fi and pads and laptops that their parents can lend them. And I've got some kids that the best they can do is maybe their mom has a smartphone and that mom works at a grocery store and needs to take that phone with her because she is essential services now and she doesn't make a lot of money. And so I can't tell these kids, go out and hook up broadband in your apartment, go out and buy an iPad. So the district told me to reach these kids digitally and they don't have access. And that really worries them, that the kids that need the most are going to fall even further behind.
Has the government done enough with these bills that they have passed recently?
No. No, the government has not done enough with the bills they've recently passed. And let me say thank you for what you did do, Congress. Thank you for all the parents and educators and folks that called. We did organize people to call. You can still do that. Their congressmen, their senators, talk about what's so important in these bills for our kids so that we weather this storm. But we had asked for some help with the homework gap, the digital divide that existed long before this coronavirus crisis. And we don't get people to take us seriously because it's like, oh, that's just like extra stuff, that technology. No, it's essential to doing the kinds of homework and research that we expect from kids today. So we are still asking for $2 billion from the federal government that they can go out to rural communities and urban communities and economically challenged communities where kids live in dire poverty, help those families with what they need, help those school districts that want to give kids what they need. And we're also looking for something greater in what is referred to as a state education stabilization fund. We're in a crisis right now. Everybody gets that, but I want you to think about 2 or 3 or 4 months down the road. All of these businesses that closed down, all of these businesses that generated sales tax, income tax, even to some extent property tax. Taxes are the life's blood of a public school. The community pays taxes, and that's how we build a school building, hire that school nurse and the teachers. That's how we keep the electricity bills paid. And now we expect some pretty dire results of this being lower, lower, lower revenue from the taxes that keep these schools up and running. So the federal government has to see a public school as an essential foundation part of the infrastructure of the state in the same way that you would build a road to get from here to there. You have to build a school to get from where you are to the future. And they have not given states enough money to make sure that kids get what they need when we go back to normal.
One thing that you did talk about, and it's something I wrote down before we spoke, special education. What are the needs that can be met digitally?
We are so challenged in the way that we can serve children with special needs when they can't be in that loving classroom with specially designed environments for them. For some of these kids, they're medically fragile. And for some of these kids, they're emotionally fragile. We have a lot of counselors and school psychologists who are saying, we were helping kids who had been bullied or were sometimes, and I hate to be dramatic, but it is dramatic, that these were kids who were in danger of hurting themselves. And they have therapists working with these kids, especially when parents can't afford a private psychologist. If the kids don't get these special therapists and specialists at school, they don't get it at all. And so these are folks that have been doing one-on-one. They've been calling, they've been FaceTiming with their students to make sure they're okay in this stressful time. But when you're dealing with kids with cognitive disabilities or physical disabilities, to look at the limits that we have in a home environment is very challenging. I don't want anyone to think that we are just saying, so we can't do it. It means that those are the teachers that are most worried about working with parents who have very different environments in very different homes, and they are reaching their colleagues across the country to get ideas about how folks are handling things. These are students that have legal rights to certain services. And if you can't show up at school and the teacher cannot show up at your home because your home is, you're in quarantine in your own home, or your teacher is being asked to stay in her home, you have to be very, very creative about how you're reaching these students.
A lot of teachers' job descriptions are being rewritten on the fly. Is there any problem with the contracts, or is everything just flexible right now?
You know, I am so proud of the teachers and the educators, the support staff in America's schools right now, because I have had the opportunity to talk to hundreds of people and thousands, if you include all of the webinars and the electronic convenings that we've had. I've had teachers ask a million questions. I have not had one teacher say, this is unfair, this isn't in my contract, I'm not going to be doing that. They've been worried about their students' health. They've been worried about their own health. They don't want to put anyone at risk. But no one has said, that's not in my contract, so I'm not doing this. Every single teacher that I've talked to understands we're in a national crisis, understands that we're the ones keeping kids safe, and that we're giving them a meaningful educational experience under horrible circumstances. They know their country, not just their kids and the kids' families, that we get that every day, that these kids are counting on us. But we now know that our country is counting on us.
Lily Eskelson Garcia was named Utah Teacher of the Year in 1989 and is now the president of the National Education Association. So we've heard the big picture from the NEA, but how are the changes being implemented on the ground? To find out, the best of our knowledge is Lucas Willard spoke with Russell Brown, a high school earth science teacher in the Glens Falls City School District in northern New York. He spoke about his experience over the last month and how the day-to-day routine for him and his students has been upended.
You know, I miss going in and actually seeing the students every day. It's a tough thing to go from seeing hundreds of people a day to literally seeing four walls every day. And it's tough to, you know, miss out on students coming in and saying, hey, Mr. Brown, I just saw this. Hey, Mr. Brown, I just saw that. It's you know, I miss out on the students coming in and saying, Mr. Brown, do we have a double period today? It's tough. I think everybody's handling it differently. But it was a quick overnight change. And I would love to be back in school right now.
You're a pretty tech-savvy guy. You've done a lot of online instruction before, but how is this different when it comes to your typical online quizzes or tests or other materials?
The quizzes and tests are more or less the same as far as what I was already doing digitally. The bigger part is I can't walk or physically walk around a classroom right now and say, you know, so-and-so, can you get back to work? So-and-so, can you focus? The responsibility of engaging with the content has shifted from me keeping students on task to purely students keeping themselves on task in whatever home environment they're in.
Right. And that's,
so I think that
might be a little more predictable for a college student who is a little more mature, but at the middle school, high school level, that's a little bit different, right?
Sure. That's a huge shift. And that goes back to kind of the, you know, asking students to make that shift overnight, you know, asking adults to make that shift overnight is a difficult thing to do. And I think everybody in the nation is grappling with that. Asking middle schoolers and high schoolers to do that is that much more, you know, is that they're that much further away from being at that level of responsibility and working. So it's a tough challenge for sure.
Are teachers in your district all communicating on best ways to sort of adapt and, hey, I did it this way, this worked out for me? Are the teachers communicating even when school is not in session?
That's been one of the silver linings, actually, is seeing all of the kind of community resources that have been pulled together, all of the things that BOCES has put out, that NYSED has put out, that local teachers and within the district has been put out, really seeing how people have kind of stepped up to do that, putting all the lunches out for students during this time has been a real big effort, and mostly that was done through volunteers, and that's still going on as of now. So that's been really cool to see.
And do you have any advice for parents who might be listening about what they can do to help their students learn even when they can't go to school?
That's a good one. I would say communicate. Try to find some sort of schedule that students can be following, you know, whether it be, you know, today you're working for a half an hour on this or a half an hour on that, getting that schedule up and running and trying to keep to that schedule as much as possible, I think would help some students. Just kind of build those habits. And once it becomes a habit, then it's a little bit easier to continue on with.
Russell Brown is a high school earth science teacher in the Glens Falls City School District in Glens Falls, New York. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Lucas Willard. Still to come, young minds are not the only ones being affected by the pandemic. We'll hear how seniors with Alzheimer's are coping next on the best of our knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. While the COVID-19 pandemic threatens the health of millions in this country and around the world, the novel coronavirus presents unique challenges for the more than 5 million Americans living with Alzheimer's and their caregivers. To help family caregivers navigate the current complex and quickly changing environment, the Alzheimer's Association is offering additional guidance to families. The Best of Our Knowledge's Elizabeth Hill spoke with Beth Kallmeyer, the Vice President of Care and Support with the Alzheimer's Association, about the risk factors for patients living with Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia.
Individuals living with dementia or Alzheimer's aren't at greater risk just because of the dementia or Alzheimer's per se, but they are at greater risk because typically those folks that have dementia are over the age of 65, so they're in that risk category. And they likely, many of them have comorbid conditions that increase the risk for them in terms of COVID-19. Some other things to think about that are different for dementia caregivers when they're taking care of someone living with dementia is, of course, they need to pay attention to the CDC guidelines and the hygiene protocols. But somebody living with dementia or cognitive impairment may not remember to implement those protocols. So they may need help washing their hands. They may need reminders to wash their hands. We're suggesting that families think about, you know, putting signs up in the bathroom or maybe at the kitchen sink, maybe even setting up a hand-washing schedule just to make sure that those things are happening, because the person isn't necessarily going to remember, even if they're in the earlier stages of the disease, that they need to be doing that. When you're taking care of somebody with dementia, they might not be able to understand the context of what's going on, but they can understand and react to the caregiver's levels of stress or what their emotional state is. And so what we're advising caregivers to do is to really think about that and to make sure that they're taking care of themselves in a way, because the person could react to their levels of stress. So, for example, you know, not having the TV on all day, not always listening to the news all day. We need to know what's going on, but limiting that and then staying focused in the present with the person and trying to engage them in activities around the house, whatever it is, if it's folding laundry or making cookies or whatever it is that you can do with that person to engage them and manage caregiver's level of stress as well as then the person who's living with dementia.
What type of resources can caregivers find with your organization?
So the Alzheimer's Association operates a 24/7 helpline. That helpline is staffed with dementia specialists as well as master's level social workers, counselors. So families facing this can call the helpline and get individualized assistance, problem solving, strategizing, education about the disease, education about tips so that they can put a plan in place in terms of how they're providing care and also, you know, really get support. This is a really difficult time for everybody in our country, but for people taking care of somebody living with dementia, they might not have some of the same resources they've had access to in the past. People aren't going to day centers anymore or senior centers. They're not going to have that same kind of access. And so they need to be able to talk to other folks and get a sense of that they're doing okay and, you know, just a reminder of what they're doing that's working well.
What is the number that they can call?
Yeah, that number is 800-272-3900, and it is staffed 24 hours a day. So if someone's worried about something at 4 in the morning, they can give us a call and they'll be able to talk to somebody. Another thing we're talking to families about, especially family caregivers, is really, really critical that if they're taking care of someone living with dementia, they have to think about what plan B might be in terms of what happens if they get sick. I mean, obviously, you know, nobody wants that to happen and they're going to take steps to avoid it. But the reality is it could. And if families have talked about this ahead of time, if they've jumped on a conference call with other family members or friends to say, hey, what's our plan if the main caregiver ends up getting sick, then if that does happen, they're going to have a plan they can enact instead of having it happen and then everyone's scrambling.
Is there any sort of backup plan that the Alzheimer's Association is working with? I mean, health aides, companionship that people bring in?
Certainly we have access to other community resources. We have a database called Community Resource Finder that could help families locate perhaps other help to come in if they need to bring in outside help. And, you know, that's going to vary depending on where they are in the country in terms of what's available. So we would, you know, those are conversations that if a family is stuck and they don't have someone that could step in, if a family caregiver, you know, they could call the helpline and we would help strategize on what other options might be available. And, you know, it's complicated, to be honest. There's not easy answers to some of these things.
How are you changing your organization to help people in this time of self-quarantining?
Yeah, so the Alzheimer's Association offers support groups and community programs, engagement programs, education programs face-to-face in general. And during this pandemic time, we transitioned our support groups to virtual. So they're either on telephone calls or on video conferencing, depending on the attendees' capabilities. And then we've also transitioned our community education programs into virtual webinars. So we're offering those services throughout the country. People can go to our website and get linked to different options for them in terms of support groups or education programs.
That was the best of our knowledge as Elizabeth Hill speaking with the Alzheimer's Association Vice President of Care and Support, Beth Kallmeyer. To learn more about the resources provided by the Alzheimer's Association during the COVID-19 pandemic, visit alz.org. Thank you. Well, so far on today's program, we've talked about COVID-19 and Alzheimer's disease. Let's go for the hat trick and talk about some researchers who are fishing for a treatment for Parkinson's disease. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
There might not be one cure for Parkinson's disease. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Barbara Christie Pope, professor of biology, explores why we may have to go down several avenues to reach the goal.
Parkinson's disease is the second most common neurodegenerative disease behind Alzheimer's. Early on, Parkinson's disease displays as a movement disorder. Patients have tremors or difficulty standing or walking because of involuntary movements or muscle rigidity. Cognitive deficits appear in the later stages of the disease. I collaborate with researchers at the University of Iowa who are using a zebrafish model to examine movement disorders. The zebrafish we study are mutant fish that exhibit degeneration of the same neurons that cause the disease in humans. The fish have a movement disorder and do not swim very well. In fact, they don't survive to adulthood because of this deficit. We look at them at the embryonic stage. These fish lack the same cell that degenerates in the brains of individuals with Parkinson's disease. So we are exploring if what's happening in the fish is also happening to people with the disease. This summer, we looked at a particular ion channel to determine whether or not it could be involved in the death of these cells. The ion channel helps to regulate the ion magnesium. Magnesium deficits have been implicated in people with Parkinson's disease, and studies suggest that these individuals have lower levels of magnesium in their brains. Our goal was to examine the role of magnesium by manipulating the levels of magnesium in the fish. Parkinson's disease is likely multifactorial, but involves the role of genes and the environment. Determining these many factors will give us an idea of the cause of the disease and hopefully a way to prevent the occurrence of the disease or stop the progression of factors that leads to the disease.
That was Barbara Christie Pope of Cornell College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org. Thank you.